Investors Chronicle.
Welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show, and welcome to Checks Notes 2023. Very exciting. While the calendars are updated, you'll be pleased to hear our lineup is still very much of a 2022 vintage. And speaking of being stuck in the past, our first guest, Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, John.
Julian Hoffman as well. Hi, Julian.
Hello, yes, not far behind.
Alex Newman.
Hi, John.
Hiya. And in the studio, Gemma Slingo's here.
Hi, John.
Hi, Gemma. Good to have you. And Dan Jones, Happy New Year. What's coming up today?
Happy New Year, John. That was a very savage introduction of Mark. but yeah, we've got a few things today. We're recording this on Thursday, and there's quite a few retailer trading updates out today of interest and of note. So we're going to be talking about those in particular next, but also touching on a couple of others as well and what they might say about the year ahead. Then we are discussing this week's cover feature, which is our annual Ideas of the Year selection. So Alex will be on hand to talk about that. And finally, we're going to talk about quantitative tightening, the reversal of quantitative easing, I should say, as is taking place to differing degrees, differing extents in developed markets. We're particularly going to look at Europe and then touch on the UK as well.
News from the first week of the year before we get there. And a reminder, we're speaking on Thursday the 5th. First up, activity in the UK's manufacturing sector fell for the sixth successive month in December, with output, new orders and employment all declining at faster rates. The sector's decline looks set to continue into 2023, especially when government support for energy bills are cut, according to a senior economist. On a more positive note, however, new car registrations increased for a fifth successive month in December as the chip shortage begins to ease. However, the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders did note that the market remains well adrift of pre-pandemic performance. Cineworld shares fell 7% after the bankrupt cinema giant denied it had held talks with AMC Entertainment over selling assets to it. The company says it is aiming to rejig its structure and sell the entire business. Homeless accommodation landlord Home REIT on Tuesday suspended its shares due to its failure to publish its financial results on time. And then on Wednesday, the company's investment advisor Alvarium sold the part of its arm responsible for managing Home REIT for £24 million. Mitchell Labiak, our property writer, has plenty of Home REIT coverage on the IC website if you wish to decipher this chaos further. Shell have a new boss. Wael Sawan has said he was daunted but excited to tackle the huge challenges faced by the oil and gas industry. He replaces Ben van Beurden, who'd been in charge since 2014. And Amazon plans to cut 18,000 jobs as the company looks to rein in costs. The majority of the cuts will come in the company's stores unit, which includes its e-commerce business and its HR division, according to a blog post from CEO Andy Jassy. Elsewhere, an IMF official has urged the Federal Reserve to not ease rate hikes yet, despite data suggesting US and European inflation might have peaked. Geeta Gopinath, the fund's second-in-command, said Jay Powell and co. should stay the course. And indeed, notes from the Fed's December meeting, released this Thursday morning, indicated none of the central bank officials anticipated cutting rates this year. That's all from me. Over to Dan with the rest of the show.
Thanks, John. Yeah, so we'll start with what has turned out to be a bit of New Year cheer from some retailers today, starting with Next. Contrast in some ways couldn't be greater from its September update, which was rather doomy. Gemma, you've looked at the trading update today, and it's not quite a case of everything's going to be fine all year, but it certainly seems much more optimistic than they did just a few months ago.
Yes, it was quite a cheerful read, actually, on quite a gloomy January morning. So back in September, when Next half-year results were out, it was quite doom and gloom. They were saying that pre-tax profits for the full year were going to be lower than they previously expected. Inflation was raging. Consumer spending was down. So I think the market was braced for quite a miserable update today. But actually, Christmas turned out to be way stronger than they were expecting. So in the 9 weeks up to the 30th of December, sales actually rose by 5% when they thought they'd be down by about 2%. And generally, the mood was a lot brighter. So they actually reversed their profit guidance, again saying it would reach what they originally thought it would, which was about £20 million more than what they were forecasting in September. So, yeah, good news for investors, I think.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a round trip, I think, hasn't it? Because I think they're ending up with the exact figure they forecast at the start of last year. So having guided down, they're guiding up again. But I think, to be fair to Next, you know, some other companies, perhaps you might say, well, this is just a case of managing expectations well and then beating them. But this does seem to be a bit of a change in thinking. And we have seen some retail figures this week, the past couple of weeks, in terms of the Christmas period, proving slightly better than expected, maybe not quite to the same extent as the Next shift that we saw there. But it was also interesting, a couple of points in their trading updates, or very detailed as usual, is that it still seems they're still finding out new things about how the business was operating, you know, back in the pandemic. I think they said they underestimated both the impact of coronavirus on sales last year, but also how stock shortages may have dampened demand last year as well. So it's quite interesting from that point that, you know, we're now in 2023 and people are still, you know, realising things about how the business is performing year on year that they maybe weren't quite aware of a few months ago.
Yeah, and I think it's making us question some of the habits we think are quite ingrained now. So it was interesting looking at how they divided up online shopping to in-person shopping. So both in the last quarter of the year and in the second half of the year, it was in-person sales that were really driving the growth. So they were up 12.5% in the 9 weeks up to the 30th of December. And that does sort of make you stop and think, well, do people really love online shopping as much as we think they do? Or were sort of shopping habits being repressed all this time by COVID? And actually there might be this more positive wave back into high streets and retail, actual sort of brick and mortar stores. So, yeah, I think quite a lot of businesses will be looking at these with interest and thinking, have we got it completely right?
I was when I had a look at it this morning, it just occurred to me there might be a psychological aspect to this as well, because this is the first Christmas trading period that we've had, which hasn't been had the shadow of COVID-19 hanging over it. And it might just represent the fact that people were hankering to return back to a degree of normality. That's, you know, purely speculative on my part. But there are some other interesting aspects to it. I think Gemma's analysis brought it out pretty well, that looking at other retailers going forward, there's three interlinked areas that are going to have a major bearing on earnings in the coming months, and that's the level of full price sales, i.e. discounting, inventory levels, and also stock turn and debtor days. You know, those are sort of rather boring metrics there, but they relate to one another, and they're going to determine earnings throughout the retail sector and other sectors as well. I was thinking about tourism the other day as well. So it's worth keeping that in mind. One other point I'd like to make as well is that we should have been well past the high point of the credit cycle by now. But if reports are to be believed, it seems obvious that households are now using credit cards to meet their everyday needs. So, you know, that's going to have an, you know, the level of discretionary spending / discretionary income will also have a bearing as the year moves on. But it's certainly a positive beat post-Christmas.
The other thing I was going to mention was cost inflation. Next, as usual, giving pretty detailed forecasts for the year ahead. And on costs as well, there's a bit more good news, it seems. I think they're now saying spring and summer ranges will cost 8% more than last year. Autumn winter lines about 6% more, which, again, sounds better in terms of, i.e., less severe than they were saying in September. That might partly be due to the change we've seen in sterling. I think part of the warning in September was due to the fact that sterling was down at 105 against the dollar, and now obviously we're somewhat stronger. But perhaps there's also signs there. I think management have been saying in recent months, again, even in that September update, there are signs of improvement there on the inflation side of things as well. So perhaps that's another green shoots to look forward to this year?
Yeah, you'd hope so. I mean, they do caveat it slightly by saying the autumn winter estimates are estimates, so they're still negotiating on prices. But they mention that cotton and polyester prices seem to be coming down and that factory capacity seems to be improving, which should hopefully mean they can sell their products at more reasonable prices and keep enticing customers into their stores.
The other thing we should touch on, as I said at the top, a couple of other results today, Greggs and B&M. Again, both of which not quite as positive as Next, but certainly fairly positive in the context of what we've been told and what we kind of think about retailers at the moment in terms of where we are in the economy and with consumer demand, that kind of thing. So again, putting a fairly optimistic spin on it for the start of the year. The flip side to that, perhaps, is I was just having a look this morning on a very, you know, basic level. I was quite surprised to see that share prices for all these companies are actually up, you know, 50% since the September lows. So in some cases, the price is up with the facts, perhaps. Mark, I don't know if you have any thoughts about the sector in general. I know you touched on some of the things to watch in the months ahead, but, you know, is there a chance that there is too much doom and gloom about and things won't be that bad, or...?
It's difficult to say, really. It's highly subjective, but the market is obviously, well, in the lead up to Christmas, the market was obviously pricing in some fairly dire outcomes. Greggs was interesting insofar as that it was one of the companies that reacted most promptly to the problems brought about by the pandemic. And I don't know. I think it's a lesson in good management for the company as well. They're back into an expansionary mode. They opened just under 190 outlets through next year. I think the main issue for Greggs now is trying to work out which are the most profitable circumstances under which to open their stores as well. And that's because, you know, we've seen some fairly profound post-pandemic changes, not least of which the changes in hybrid working patterns, and that's affected their planning process too. When you were talking briefly before was about Next as well. Obviously, a fair proportion of their cost base is linked to energy prices, and they're going to remain elevated through much of this year, I would imagine, but perhaps the situation isn't quite so dire as market sentiment would have had us to believe midway through last year.
Well, fingers crossed on that front. But we are at the start of the year, as everyone will know, and that brings us to our cover feature this week, which is our ideas of the year, looking at a selection of companies and other securities, as we may come on to in a moment, that we think have some potential for the 12 months ahead. So Alex Newman, our ideas editor, is with us as per. Alex, maybe we start by sort of talking about the thinking behind how we structure these ideas and how we choose them and the way that has changed slightly this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was going to maybe start partly to introduce the feature, which, I mean, it'd be familiar to lots of our regular listeners and long-term readers. I mean, in a way, it's a little bit of a contradiction in terms, because we often talk and write about investment ideas, I suppose, in terms of, you know, several years and the kind of buy and hold case for companies rather than a single year. And yet, yeah, as you said, I mean, our flagship first issue of each year is precisely a relatively short term view, in that, you know, we're looking for stocks that are going to do well in 2023, not necessarily just focusing on the case, you know, over the next 5 years. But I mean, that's sort of how we do things in the media and financial markets, I suppose. So there's that framing. And it's kind of a good discipline as well, because it means we do, you know, hold ourselves to a bit of account. And the, you know, the ability to see more than a year out does get harder when you're looking at the investment case for any one asset. So it's not, it's not a meaningless exercise. That aside, as you alluded to, we have made a few tweaks to how we're doing it this year. I mean, and the main point of that is to reflect the, you know, really the sea change in investor sentiment that we've seen over the past year. So, you know, in essence, and we've talked about this lots of times on the podcast, but it really amounts to much greater skepticism about the long-term promises companies are making, and a greater focus on the near-term profitability. And we can't talk about this enough, really, sort of the fundamental value of stocks. So this year, you know, if I was going to paint it in broad brush strokes, there's a little bit of less of a focus on pricey quality names and a bit more of a bent towards value and income. I think that wouldn't necessarily say a herd view, but that I think that reflects this new market reality. And you know, what that means in practice is a bit of a change to most of the 5-10 stock portfolios we put together. And when I say portfolios, these are kind of more 10 stocks which encapsulate a market theme or idea which we think are going to stand a chance in 2023.
Yeah, as you say, that they are themes rather than diversified portfolios, each of them, but there's plenty of info in there on each company, as you would expect. But they're not just equities, not just stocks this year as well. We got a couple of different securities in there, if we want to speak about them, perhaps.
I may drag Julian in here. You know, I'm not going to give away all the names of the companies we're looking at this year, but one is one which Julian highlighted, which I think is very interesting, which does kind of, in a way, if you're going to encapsulate the options facing investors at the start of 2023, it's quite an interesting test case. So Julian pointed out that general accident preference shares, it is an equity, but it has some quirks, which mean it's quite different to you know, the shares we talk about normally in the mag. Looking like quite an interesting investment case there. What that investment case is, essentially, is a good yield. So it's yielding over 7% at the moment. And it's backstopped by a company in Aviva, which has, you know, has you know, been very well led over the last couple of years, and we think is increasingly a solid proposition. You know, the potential for capital appreciation is rather limited, and I think you could probably make that case of lots of companies out there. But, you know, if there is, you know, by the end of this year, a little bit of a slightly less gloomy outlook, there is that potential for capital appreciation there alongside the yield. So it is perhaps a slightly conservative view that we're highlighting a preference share, which stock pickers would say, you know, that's basically a, you know, a quasi bond. Hopefully that helps explains a little bit about our approach, and which is quite cautious at the start of this year to equity markets.
Yeah, so you're right, Alex. It's an interesting investment case. I'm obviously waiting for the very angry letters to the editor on the fact that we've highlighted a preference share. But the basic case really is that the yield compression has ended, and it's kind of left these instruments looking far more attractive than they have in a decade. I mean, I remember when, you know, you could pick these up at maybe 110 in the pound, and then they went as high as like 150, 160 during the period when we couldn't get any interest or any yield at all on anything. The bearishness around it has actually been a positive for this particular instrument, and on the basis that you should only really buy things when they're in relative terms cheap, then it seemed like a good bet for a tip of the year. But Alex is right, it's not, you can't really treat it like a share. You have to almost think of it as a bond, but obviously it doesn't have the same features of a bond in that you don't own any bits of the company. But It's an interesting segue, I think, into the prefs market, and one which, you know, the readers tend to like overall.
Yeah, as you say, you know, technically an equity, but certainly more bond like than we're used to. And I was also thinking of investment companies as well, which we haven't included in the ideas of the year before, and we do continue to do so as well. So there is that diversification there in terms of the choice of instrument. But we should be clear, shouldn't we, that you know, these are in the main equities and companies that, you know, common stock that we think shows potential for the year ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned, you alluded to there, the investment companies or investment trusts is another, you know, group of 10 a sort of 10 share portfolio as well that we're highlighting for a different reason there. Being that they, you know, there are some enormous discounts on offer for in some of the investment trust universe, some of it warranted, some of it starting to look like value territory. In some cases, there's kind of a double discount because they're buying, you know, some trusts or funds are buying into other funds, which are themselves discounted. So that is, you know, one of the, what seems to me and a few others on the team, like, a, you know, one of the greatest, I suppose, opportunities for value investors at the moment in UK markets. But yeah, a little bit different to how we'd normally look at sort of share ideas at the start of a year.
Yeah, and in terms of how we normally do and how we've done in the past, we should reflect on last year's ideas, which, in the spirit of self-criticism and perhaps in contrast to the regular weekly ideas, which performed pretty well in some, we had some issues with the ideas of the year last year, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's really bad. The performance was really bad. I mean, I think I wrote in another piece this week that, I mean, anecdotally, at least, it was retail investors who were most overweight, you know, the kind of highly valued, high promise growth stocks at the end of 2021 or the start of 2022. I mean, in reality, most equity investors probably were. And it's not clear to me that the fund managers, you know, avoided this mistake as it proved to be. But I mean, it's interesting looking back on a year ago, our picks certainly show the biases of this kind of post-pandemic investing themes. So, you know, quality was really still the big game in town. Growth, long-term sort of long-term promise stocks, were kind of like the market story du jour. And our picks, because we were kind of quite overweight that sort of growth quality story, it really didn't hold up particularly well against the benchmarks against which we compare them to, so both the FTSE World and the FTSE All Share. So, you know, in trying to explain our picks for this year, I've kind of reflected a little bit on how we did last year, or how last year's picks did. And I think, you know, on balance, this is kind of slightly more income and value focused approach is probably warranted given what, you know, we now know things are very uncertain. It may not have been quite as clear how sort of bleak and uncertain things were last January.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed for our portfolios this year. And certainly I think the diversity of options on offer should provide some food for thought for everyone. But we're going to turn now to our final segment of the week. We are talking quantitative tightening, which is a phrase I hope not to repeat too many more times on today's show, because I think I got away with the correct pronunciation there. Julian, I think you wanted to talk about this a little bit. We'll start with Europe and the impact there, because the ECB, as everyone else has been over the past few months, is tightening policy. It is planning to shrink its €5 trillion worth portfolio of bonds this year, at the same time as issuance from countries in the euro area is expected to increase. So there's a bit of a tension there.
Yeah, so basically the biggest buyer of euro bonds is about to exit the market. I mean, that's the sum total of this. The ECB is going to dial down its bond buying program by roughly €15 billion a month, although the estimates tend to vary. I think that'll end up being how the underlying economy performs in some ways. But it is an inflection point for the Eurozone, because there are countries that are reliant on issuing quite large amounts of debt. Chief among them, obviously, is Italy. Every rise of 2 or 3 basis points in Italy's yield adds several more billion to their interest bill. And it's a very awkward, but probably necessary step that the ECB has to take, and they can only hope that the architecture that they designed since 2010 is able to take the strain of the tightening without causing a meltdown, such as happened to Greece or Ireland. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, this is really one of the big unknowns for the year ahead, isn't it? Or an unknown unknown, if you will, compared to the known unknown of inflation and interest rates. And even though we may be at a stage, albeit not quite in the Eurozone, where rates are peaking, this, you know, withdrawal of liquidity is something that, you know, obviously has never happened before, because we never had quantitative easing reversing before. So really, no one knows how it's going to play out. I mean, is there a potential impact for the banking sector as well in Europe?
Well, there clearly is. Certainly the market is betting on that, because the valuations, unlike in the UK and the US, are struggling to gain any altitude. you can pick up quite good EU banking shares for under a PE of 7, sometimes 6, 6.5. And the problem, I think, is that the market is reckons that somebody is going to have to buy these bonds. And because banks have a sort of regulatory, live under a kind of regulatory stranglehold, there is, you know, there could be a 50-50 chance that governments will force banks to take on more liquid, more capital by buying up government bonds in a way, sort of increasing their risk-weighted assets by, you know, 1 or 2% possibly. And that is definitely having an impact on the shares. It's actually having more of an impact than the price of a recession, which is interesting. And actually, the threat of recession in some ways is lifting in some countries. You know, there was recent data from Germany and France where manufacturing seems to be picking up, as I think we picked up on the UK as well. So the biggest threat, I would say, is probably this regulatory overhang from the bond market that could force banks to increase their levels of liquidity at a time when they were looking to give back capital to shareholders. So there is a definite risk there.
Final point, because we have to wrap up very shortly, but I just wanted to touch on the UK as well. Obviously, the UK is also going through its own quantitative tightening process, and slightly different from Europe insofar as the ECB is effectively letting these bonds roll off, whereas the UK is actively selling bonds before they mature. So a slightly more aggressive strategy. And, you know, there is the question of, you know, who will be the buyer in the UK market as well. Obviously, pension funds have had a bit of a shock in recent months. Could we see sort of a similar overhang for the UK in the months ahead?
It's difficult to say with any certainty in the UK, because the main market for government bonds in the UK is, as you say, the pension funds and the major banks. And we don't have the wide of as variety of buyers as you get in Europe or the US. So the demand is slightly different. I think it's about 80% domestic to 20% foreign buyers. And I don't think that proportion is going to change very much, or at least it would have to be very, you know, there would have to be quite a different, they'd have to offer keener prices on the bonds in order to get more outside buyers to buy them, I think. But we could be, you know, we're in a rate increasing cycle, and there must come a point where it's the value of sterling plus the rates that are being offered by the Bank of England is going to make foreign buyers come back and perhaps take on that debt. But at the moment, it's just too early. It's just too early to tell. And judging by the price action, it's not something that the market is looking at the banks and saying that this could be a problem.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, perhaps the kindness of strangers will help us out again later this year. Thank you, Julian. That does bring us to the end of the show. So thank you to everyone this week. Thank you to Gemma and to Mark and to Alex and to John as well. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.